So, hello.
And
welcome to our continued reading in the 10th chapter in the Life Divine, Book 2, Knowledge by Identity and Separative Knowledge. It might be wise to remind ourselves that he has described in his view of epistemology, the study of knowledge, how we come to know what are the principles of being, that there are basically four kinds, as he sees it. Knowledge by identity, knowledge by direct contact. Separative direct contact is a third type of knowledge, and the last is knowledge by separative indirect contact. In the section we just ended last time, he was examining the nature of the subliminal worlds as they are explored and examined by the growing consciousness of the individual. We're going to take it a bit farther tonight and look at the nature of the subliminal as it also oceans out into the cosmic. This first paragraph, then. But the subliminal being has also a larger direct contact with the world. It is not confined, like the surface mind, to the interpretation of sense images and sense vibrations supplemented by the mental and vital intuition and the reason. And in case it's necessary, the subliminal being Sri Aurobindo talks about is a larger ground of consciousness. This is not the subconscient of Western psychology, not even the subconscient as he refers to it, which to him is a diminished awareness close to the inconscient. The subliminal is a larger consciousness than the surface existence which we experience. And subliminal, once we penetrate that wall and gain access to it, allows us to range with more fluidity among all the inner realms that are the planes in the cosmos. So those planar realms are the region of the mind, the region of the life force, the region of the subtle physical, all of which compose our inner being, what we call subliminal, meaning behind the line of consciousness. Here, since our normal reference point is the external consciousness, the subliminal is that which is behind our awareness. But it is not low, it is not subconscient, it is merely other conscient. It has its own inner wakefulness. He's been describing that. So, as he put it elsewhere in the Life Divine, in the chapter just recently we covered, Cosmic Illusion, the subliminal self is a kind of meeting point between the evolving powers of our consciousness and the involving powers from above. So greater states of awareness, which want to impart their light and force into us, are meeting those growing elements of our nature as they rise out of the mud, as it were, of the subconscious and the external life. So let's go back, and again, I'm sorry, let's reread that first sentence. But the subliminal... Can I? But the subliminal being has also a larger direct contact with the world. It is not confined, like the surface mind, to the interpretation of sense images and sense vibrations supplemented by the mental and vital intuition and the reason. There is indeed an inner sense in the subliminal nature, a subtle sense of vision, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. But these are not confined to the creation of images of things belonging to the physical environment. They can present to the consciousness visual, auditory, tactual, and other images and vibrations of things beyond the restricted range of the physical senses or belonging to other planes or spheres of existence. This, in a sense, allows him to speak of the inner senses, not the external senses, sight, touch, etc., but their inner aspects. And this is, of course, close to the Sankhya scheme, where the external senses extend themselves into the objects that they touch and taste, etc., but are themselves extensions of inner senses. So we're seeing a hierarchy of being, a grading of more sensitive instruments, which don't rely on the externalities and are capable of ranging beyond gross objects into other realms of existences. This inner sense, he says, can create or present images, scenes, sounds that are symbolic rather than actual, or that represent possibilities in formation, suggestions, thoughts, ideas, intentions of other beings, image forms also of powers or potentialities in universal nature. There is nothing that it cannot imagine or visualize or turn into sensory formations. So this is a power far beyond what ordinarily we ascribe to senses. They can range then into psychological and potential realms and modes of being and deliver information and deliver them in symbolic form. Now, as we'll see, key to symbolism is the consciousness to unlock the key. These forms may be symbolic. Are they intelligible to us? So he continues, it is the subliminal in reality and not the outer mind that possesses the powers of telepathy, clairvoyance, second sight, and other supernormal faculties whose occurrence in the surface consciousness is due to openings or rifts in the wall erected by the outer personality's unseeing labor of individualization and interposed between itself and the inner domain of our being. So that is where it comes from. We have to have a rupture in that wall, a rift, an opening that allows these visionings to arrive to our frontal consciousness from the subliminal realms behind. You may remember earlier in the chapter he described two walls, one wall separating our inner nature from our outer, and a wall outside separating us from the greater cosmos around. So both these walls in the growth of an evolving consciousness must be taken down so that we can have true integration with both self and world. The walls are there in the early innings to allow ego to develop as a first effort towards individualization. But at some point, those walls become dispensable. Or at least we can turn them into picket fences. It should be noted, however, that owing to this complexity, the action of the subliminal sense can be confusing or misleading, especially if it is interpreted by the outer mind, to which the secret of its operations is unknown, and its principles of sign construction and symbolic figure languages foreign. A greater inner power of intuition, tact, discrimination is needed to judge and interpret rightly its images and experiences. It is still the fact that they add immensely to our possible scope of knowledge and widen the narrow limits in which our sense-bound outer physical consciousness is circumscribed and imprisoned. So this symbolism must be interpreted by a kind of growing inner tact. And all of this, of course, is a reference to the field of these inner senses, what they can deliver to us. So now we turn to another. But more important is the power of the subliminal to enter into a direct contact of consciousness with other consciousness or with objects, to act without other instrumentation. By an essential sense inherent in its own substance, by a direct mental vision, by a direct feeling of things, even by a close envelopment and intimate penetration and a return with the contents of what is enveloped or penetrated, by a direct intimation or impact on the substance of mind itself. Not through outward signs or figures, a revealing intimation or a self-communicating impact of thoughts, feelings, forces. So he's describing here a direct mental vision, contact of mind itself with objects directly, without the use of senses. And this is, of course, a reference to manas, that element of mind. Sri Aurobindo is strongly aware that when the mind wishes to dispense with the instrumentalities of the senses, it can still gain all the knowledge it wishes to have, simply through direct apprehension, by directly contacting the knowledge without the intermediaries of the senses. And this is the line that he draws here. It is by these means that the inner being achieves an immediate, intimate, and accurate, spontaneous knowledge of persons, of objects, of the occult, and to us intangible energies of world nature that surround us and impinge upon our own personality, physicality, mind force, and life force. In our surface mentality, we are sometimes aware of a consciousness that can feel or know the thoughts and inner reactions of others, or become aware of objects or happenings without any observable sense intervention or otherwise exercise powers supernormal to our ordinary capacity. But these capacities are occasional, rudimentary, vague. Their possession is proper to our concealed subliminal self, and when they emerge, it is by a coming to the surface of its powers or operations. These emergent operations of the subliminal being, or some of them, are now fragmentarily studied under the name of psychic phenomena, although they have ordinarily nothing to do with the psyche, the soul, the inmost entity in us, but only with the inner mind, the inner vital, the subtle physical parts of our subliminal being. But the results cannot be conclusive or sufficiently ample because they are sought for by methods of inquiry and experiment and standards of proof proper to the surface mind and its system of knowledge by indirect contact. So again, when he uses the term psyche, it's a reference back to the Greek psyche, which means the soul, the inmost entity within us, of which the inner mind, vital, and subtle physical parts are extensions into the natural being, part of our subliminal nature. But the studies that he refers to as psychic phenomena. You know, can't come to any surety because, again, they're trying to measure the inside with the outside, trying to find standards of objectification which would apply to inner realms. This is very unsatisfactory and, of course, continues to come up with a zero because we're looking with the wrong instrument. What the right instrument is, of course, you've already heard him say earlier, and he'll say again in the next few sentences. Under these conditions, they can be investigated only insofar as they are able to manifest in that mind to which they are exceptional, abnormal, or supernormal, and therefore comparatively rare, difficult, incomplete in their occurrence. It is only if we can open up the wall between the outer mind and the inner consciousness to which such phenomena are normal, or if we can enter freely within or dwell there, that this realm of knowledge can be truly explained and annexed to our total consciousness and included in the field of operation of our awakened force of nature. So he suggests that it is the yogin, the practitioner, the person who's going inside studying personally the nature of consciousness, and not the measuring scientist, who will be able to get this information readily in hand, make it normal to them, no longer something rarely touched, but something of everyday experience, and be able to interpret it to the external consciousness. It suggests, then, that our poise of awareness can be normally in the subliminal realms of our nature. It need not be on the surface. We may be able to sit in a regal manner. Regal means it would still have mastery of its external kingdom, its nature, but poised more deeply, acting from greater depth, with more richness and more light, even if all we refer to is the powers of mind and life. The lucidity of the body, the externality of our physical frame, would be improved because we would also be importing not just greater life energy and mind energy into us, but also the true reflection of the subtle physical back into our physical nature. The physical nature itself would want to reflect and adhere to what its true model is inside. The outer would be molded by the inner. Because our center of gravity has gone within, so to speak, or because our poise is deeper. The throne has been placed deeper into outside the antechamber and deeper into the rooms inside the mansion. In our surface mind, we have no direct means of knowing even other men who are of our own kind and have a similar mentality and are vitally and physically built on the same model. We can acquire a general knowledge of the human mind and the human body and apply it to them with the aid of the many constant and habitual outer signs of the human inner movements with which we are familiar. These summary judgments can be farther eked out by our experience of personal character and habits, by instinctive application of what self-knowledge we have to our understanding and judgment of others, by inference from speech and conduct, by insight of observation and insight of sympathy. But the results are always incomplete and very frequently deceptive. Our inferences are, as often as not, erroneous constructions. Our interpretation of the outward signs, a mistaken guesswork. Our application of general knowledge or our self-knowledge, baffled by elusive factors of personal difference, our very insight uncertain and unreliable. Human beings, therefore, live as strangers to each other, at best, tied by a very partial sympathy and mutual experience. We do not know enough. We do not know as well as we know ourselves, and that itself is little, even those nearest to us. But in the subliminal inner consciousness, it is possible to become directly aware of the thoughts and feelings around us, to feel their impact, to see their movements. To read a mind and a heart becomes less difficult, a less uncertain venture. Once inside, we have access to a better knowledge. There is a constant mental, vital, subtle physical interchange going on between all who meet or live together, of which they are themselves unaware, except insofar as its impacts and interpenetrations touch them as sensible results of speech and action and outer contact. For the most part, it is subtly and invisibly that this interchange takes place, for it acts indirectly, touching the subliminal parts and through them the outer nature. But when we grow conscious in these subliminal parts, that brings consciousness also of all this interaction and subjective interchange and intermingling, with the result that we need no longer be involuntary subjects of their impact and consequence, but can accept or reject, defend ourselves or isolate. At the same time, our action on others need no longer be ignorant or involuntary and often unintentionally harmful. It can be a conscious help, a luminous interchange and a fruitful accommodation, an approach towards an inner understanding or union, not as now, a separative association with only limited intimacy or unity, restricted by much non-understanding and often burdened or endangered by a mass of misunderstanding, of mutual misinterpretation and error. So this, our social context. Now, more largely. Equally important would be the change in our dealings with the impersonal forces of the world that surround us. These we know only by their results, by the little that we can seize of their visible action and consequence. Among them, it is mostly the physical world forces of which we have some knowledge, but we live constantly in the midst of a whirl of unseen mind forces and life forces of which we know nothing. We are not even aware of their existence. To all this unseen movement and action, the subliminal inner consciousness can open our awareness, for it has a knowledge of it by direct contact, by inner vision, by a psychic sensitiveness. But at present, it can only enlighten our obtuse superficiality and outwardness by unexplained warnings, premonitions, attractions and repulsions, ideas, suggestions, obscure intuitions, the little it can get through imperfectly to the surface. The inner being not only contacts directly and concretely the immediate motive and movement of these universal forces and feels the results of their present action, but it can to a certain extent forecast or see ahead their farther action. There is a greater power in our subliminal parts to overcome the time barrier, to have the sense or feel the vibration of coming events, of distant happenings, even to look into the future. The development of this one moment consciousness, this concert, this growing awareness of the cosmic movements, not simply contacting objects, but the forces that move the objects, to see the gathering force, the momentum, the intended direction of a movement, whether it's cosmic or social or personal, to see into the future what is likely to happen. Even to look into the future. And this, of course, suggests that the growing power of the triple time vision, past, present, and future, Trikala Drishti, that is frequently treated in the synthesis of yoga and to which Sri Aurobindo has already made reference here. It is true that this knowledge proper to the subliminal being is not complete, for it is a mixture of knowledge and ignorance, and it is capable of erroneous as well as of true perception, since it works not by knowledge by identity, but by a knowledge through direct contact. And this is also a separative knowledge, though more intimate even in separation than anything that is commanded by our surface nature. So if we live from the subliminal being, we have greater depth. We have more knowledge, but it's still a mixture of knowledge and ignorance. It is still not absolute. But the mixed capacity of the inner mental and vital nature for a greater ignorance as well as a greater knowledge can be cured by going still deeper behind it to the psychic entity which supports our individual life and body. So, from the surface to the subliminal. From the subliminal, another yogic journey, an inner journey, to the true source of our individuality, the psyche, to that psychic entity. There is indeed a soul personality representative of this entity already built up within us, which puts forward a fine psychic element in our natural being. But this finer factor in our normal makeup is not yet dominant and has only a limited action. So let's look at this. There is the psyche, there is the psychic entity, if you will, and how it interfaces with its subliminal being is through this soul personality. This soul personality is that which connects the inmost soul to the subliminal and then to the outer nature. But while that is inserted into our natural being, it is not customarily in charge. Its action is typically limited in the human. So he says, then, our soul is not the overt guide and master of our thought and acts. It has to rely on the mental, vital, physical instruments for self-expression and is constantly overpowered by our mind and life force. But if once it can succeed in remaining in constant communion with its own larger occult reality, and this can only happen when we go deep into our subliminal parts, it is no longer dependent. It can become powerful and sovereign, armed with an intrinsic spiritual perception of the truth of things and a spontaneous discernment which separates that truth from the falsehood of the ignorance and inconscience. Distinguishes the divine and the undivine in the manifestation, and so can be the luminous leader of our other parts of nature. It is indeed when this happens that there can be the turning point towards an integral transformation and an integral knowledge. So it is this growing psychic tact that allows us to turn this corner. These are the dynamic functionings and pragmatic values of the subliminal cognition. But what concerns us in our present inquiry is to learn from its way of action the exact character of this deeper and larger cognition and how it is related to true knowledge. Its main character is a knowledge by the direct contact of consciousness with its object or of consciousness with other consciousness. So this is literally still within the belt of ignorance, but read farther. But in the end, we discover that this power is an outcome of a secret knowledge by identity, a translation of it into a separative awareness of things. For, as in the indirect contact proper to our normal consciousness and surface cognition, it is the meeting or friction of the living being with the existence outside it that awakens the spark of conscious knowledge, so here it is some contact that sets in action a pre-existent secret knowledge and brings it to the surface. For consciousness is one in the subject and the object, and in the contact of existence with existence, this identity brings to light or awakens in the self the dormant knowledge of this other self outside it. So we see this identity of being inside and outside begins to obtain as we advance through this direct contact from separation to unity. We are moving towards that secret knowledge by identity, as if in the very staging or architecture of the inner structure of the cosmos, these steps are already built in the power of involution, and we rediscover them. We recover them as we awaken. For consciousness is one in the subject and the object, and in the contact of existence with existence, this identity brings to light or awakens in the self the dormant knowledge of this other self outside it. But while this pre-existent knowledge comes up in the surface mind as a knowledge acquired, it arises in the subliminal as a thing seen, caught from within, remembered, as it were, or when it is fully intuitive, self-evident to the inner awareness. Or it is taken in from the object contacted, but with an immediate response as to something intimately recognizable. So this is a different order of conscious power, of knowledge that we are meeting here. It is already there and simply swept into our grasp. We reach out and get it, if it is an apprehending movement, or it is something that is met and acquired almost as if it was within us already in a comprehending movement. I know that has connotations of another greater power of consciousness, but some of its instrumentalities reach themselves into the engineered cosmos that we meet daily and which we can interface with subliminally. In the surface consciousness, knowledge represents itself as a truth seen from outside, thrown on us from the object, or as a response to its touch on the sense, a perceptive reproduction of its objective actuality. Our surface mind is obliged to give to itself this account of its knowledge because the wall between itself and the outside world is pierced by the gates of sense, and it can catch through these gates the surface of outward objects, though not what is within them. But there is no such ready-made opening between itself and its own inner being. Since it is unable to see what is within its deeper self or observe the process of the knowledge coming from within, it has no choice but to accept what it does see, the external object, as the cause of its knowledge. The gates of sense pierced, of course, is a reference to the Katha Upanishad and the the motto, the citation at the start of the chapter. Thus, all our mental knowing of things represents itself to us as objective, a truth imposed on us from outside. Our knowledge is a reflection or responsive construction reproducing in us a figure or picture or a mental scheme of something that is not in our own being. This is what it appears to tell us, that there is an object, the data that our senses gather from the object contacted or rendered to us, so it always seems to be coming from outside, when actually all of this is occurring from within side. But because we're divided from our real self through that wall, we don't have a portal to that power of knowledge. He continues, in fact, it is a hidden, deeper response to the contact, a response coming from within that throws up from there an inner knowledge of the object being itself part of our larger self. But owing to the double veil, the veil between our inner self and our ignorant surface self, and the veil between that surface self and the object contacted, it is only an imperfect figure or representation of the inner knowledge that is formed on the surface. Here we come back to the two walls, the double restriction, you might say, that makes it seem that this information is delivered to us seeming to be real, but restricted to superficial regions. I think that's far enough to go tonight, and we'll finish the chapter next week. As they say, if the Lord's willing and the creek don't rise. We read from Savitri tonight. In Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. In its own plane, a shining emperor, even in this rigid realm, mind can be king. The logic of its demigod idea in the leap of a transitional moment brings surprises of creation never achieved, even by matter's strange unconscious skill. All's miracle here, and can by miracle change. This is that secret nature's edge of might. On the margin of great immaterial planes, in kingdoms of an untrammeled glory of force, where mind is master of the life and form, and soul fulfills its thoughts by its own power, she meditates upon mighty words and looks on the unseen links that join the parted spheres. Thence to the initiate who observes her laws, she brings the light of her mysterious realms. Here, where he stands, his feet on a prostrate world, his mind no more cast into matter's mold. Over their bounds in spurts of splendid strength, she carries their magician processes and the formulas of their stupendous speech, till heaven and hell become purveyors to earth, and the universe the slave of mortal will. A mediatrix with veiled and nameless gods, whose alien will touches our human life. Imitating the world magician's ways, she invents for her self-bound free will its grooves and feigns for magic's freaks a binding cause. All worlds she makes the partners of her deeds, accomplices of her mighty violence, her daring leaps into the impossible. From every source she has taken her cunning means. She draws from the free love marriage of the plains elements for her creation's tour de force. A wonder weft of knowledge incalculable, a compendium of divine invention's feats, she has combined to make the unreal true, or liberate suppressed reality. In her unhedged Circean wonderland, pell-mell she shepherds her occult mightinesses, her mnemonics of the craft of the infinite, jets of the screened subliminal's caprice, tags of the grammary of inconscience, freedom of a sovereign truth without a law, thoughts that were born in the immortal's world, oracles that break out from behind the shrine, warnings from the daimonic inner voice, and peeps and lightning leaps of prophecy and intimations to the inner ear, abrupt interventions stark and absolute, and the superconscience's unaccountable acts have woven her balanced web of miracles and the weird technique of her tremendous art. This bizarre kingdom passed into his charge. Into the charge of Ashwapati. And in Ashwapati, you can see the luminous figure of Sri Aurobindo. So, for this evening, Namaste, Jai Ma.